So, before we jump in today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. And, they've got this really incredible full series 82 course.
Yeah, it's top tier.
It is. They have adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and like unlimited practice exams.
Yeah.
And they're weighted exactly like the real thing, which is huge.
Seriously, that weighting matters so
Oh,
much.
absolutely. So, check that out at certfuel.com. Anyway, let's get into it. Usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis,
Right.
there is this really comforting expectation of precision. It's basically engineering. Like if you fall off a ladder and break your arm, you go to the hospital, they take an x-ray, and it shows that jagged white line on the screen.
Yeah, the doctor just points right at it.
Exactly. There it is. Broken, it's clean, it's visible. It's just this binary thing.
Well, we crave that kind of certainty, right? I mean,
Yeah.
humans just love things that can be immediately categorized into a neat little box.
Holy.
It gives us this illusion of control over a messy world.
But then you step into the world of financial regulation,
Oh, boy.
right?
Yeah.
Specifically, the regulatory environment that governs how we actually open and maintain client accounts. And suddenly that x-ray machine is like completely malfunctioning.
It is. It's totally broken.
We're looking at this diagnostic landscape that is just entirely murky. I mean, consider this. You can structure the absolute perfect investment for a client, like a pristine, high-yield private placement that just perfectly matches their risk tolerance.
The economics are flawless.
Flawless. But if a single signature is missing from some obscure onboarding form,
Yeah.
or if like one specific arbitration clause isn't highlighted in the correct font size, the entire structure just collapses.
It's gone. The regulatory body does not care about your brilliant financial engineering if the paper trail is broken.
And that is the fundamental truth we are dissecting today. Welcome in, everyone. We are so thrilled you're here hanging out with us.
Glad to be here.
Because today, our mission is mastering account opening requirements. We are going to tear apart record keeping, disclosures, fiduciary rules, all of it. And listener, if you are gearing up for the Series 82 exam, I really need you to lock in right now.
Yeah, do not zone out on this one.
Seriously, because this is function two. It is worth 18% of your entire exam.
Which is massive.
That is nine scored items standing between you and a passing grade. Nine questions.
Nine items is a heavily determinative chunk of the test. And, what I find endlessly fascinating about this material is that it really strips away the glamorous Wall Street movie version of
Oh,
finance.
100%. No one is making a movie about this.
Right. We aren't talking about pitching the next multi-billion dollar tech startup. We are talking about the defensive architecture of the industry.
The plumbing.
Exactly, the plumbing. Getting a piece of paperwork wrong ruins everything. It is, honestly, the silent killer of financial careers.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to truly understand how these rules operate in the real world and, to help you permanently lock this into your brain for exam day, especially if you have ADHD like me, and find standard textbook reading completely mind-numbing, we need to bring these concepts to life.
We definitely need some context.
So we're going to introduce you to three recurring fictional characters today. They're going to be our test subjects, sort of guiding us through every regulatory trap we explore.
I love this. A case study approach is vastly superior to rote memorization. Introduce the cast.
All right, first up, we have Riley the Rep. Now, Riley is well-meaning, he's super enthusiastic, and he's a fantastic salesman who loves to close the deal.
But.
But yeah, he's somewhat prone to skipping the boring steps.
I
Moves a
know.
little too fast.
Yeah.
He operates on vibes rather than checklists.
I've known a lot of Rileys. Every compliance department in the country has a dozen Rileys. I mean, they generate revenue, but they also generate massive anxiety for the firm.
Exactly. So next we have Ingrid the investor, and Ingrid is our chameleon client today.
Okay, chameleon how?
In some of our scenarios, she's going to have just staggering wealth. Like she controls massive pension funds.
Gotcha.
But in other scenarios, she's just an everyday retail investor trying to open a basic brokerage account to buy some mutual funds. She basically represents the full spectrum of the investing public.
That's perfect. And the third character.
Finally, there's Sam. Sam the sponsor, who also doubles as Sam the supervisor.
Poor Sam.
Right. Sam is the exhausted, overworked principal at the firm who ultimately has to sign off on all of Riley's messes and try to keep the firm out of FINRA jail.
Okay, so we have Riley the rule bender, Ingrid the versatile client, and Sam the stress supervisor. Let's get to work.
Let's do it. So put yourself in Riley's shoes for a second. Riley sits down with Ingrid for the very first time. Before he can even start pulling forms out of his briefcase, he is faced with the first major regulatory hurdle.
The classification.
Yes. You cannot possibly know what paperwork to hand a client until you know exactly what category of client they belong to. I like to think of this as walking up to the velvet rope outside the hottest club in town.
Okay, I like that visual.
You have the VIP line, and you have the standard line.
Right, and in regulatory parlance, we are establishing the threshold difference between an institutional account and a non-institutional or retail account.
The VIPs versus the regular folks.
Exactly. And this account type fundamentally dictates the gravitational pull of the rules. It tells you which record-keeping duties apply, which disclosures are mandatory, and honestly, what level of hand-holding the firm is legally required to provide.
Because if Riley categorizes Ingrid wrong from the jump, a whole cascade of failures starts, right?
A massive cascade. He either skips a required record, which is a direct violation, or he applies a massive, suffocating compliance burden to an account that's actually exempt from it.
Which just frustrates the client and wastes time.
Completely wastes the firm's resources.
Okay, so let's focus on getting Ingrid into that VIP club, the institutional account. As I read the rules, there seem to be two completely distinct paths to getting past the bouncer.
There are.
I call path one the automatic VIPs and path two the size test.
That's an incredibly accurate framing. Path one relies entirely on the legal identity of the entity itself.
Okay, so who are they?
If the account holder is a bank, a savings and loan association, an insurance company, or a registered investment company like a mutual fund, they're institutional. Full stop.
Wait, let me clarify something right there. When you say registered investment company, you mean the fund itself, right? Not the individual people investing in the fund.
Correct. The entity itself. The Vanguard Fund. Not the teacher buying Vanguard shares.
Okay, got it.
And the second major bucket under Path 1 is a registered investment advisor. That means an investment advisor that is either registered with the SEC under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 or registered with the State Securities Commission.
So if Ingrid walks in acting on behalf of one of these specific entities, she's just automatically in the VIP line.
She bypasses the bouncer entirely.
To use our club analogy, path one is anyone who shows up wearing the neon yellow staff t-shirt. The bouncer at the velvet rope doesn't care who they are, he doesn't care how tall they are, and he absolutely does not care how much money they have in their wallet.
Exactly.
They're wearing the bank charter t-shirt or the SEC registration t-shirt, so they just walk right in.
The absence of a monetary threshold in path one is a huge concept for the exam. Size is completely irrelevant.
Right, totally irrelevant.
Totally.
Yeah.
A tiny three-person local registered investment advisor operating out of a strip mall gets the exact same institutional treatment as a trillion-dollar global insurance conglomerate.
That's wild. Why?
Because the regulators assume that these entities are already heavily regulated by other bodies like the OCC, the FDIC, or state insurance commissioners. So FINRA doesn't need to treat them like helpless retail consumers. They know what they're doing.
Okay, but let's change the scenario. What if Ingrid is just Ingrid?
Right, a normal person.
Yeah, what if she's a wildly successful individual entrepreneur? Or maybe she runs a massive private manufacturing corporation that is definitely not a bank or an insurance company.
She doesn't have the staff t-shirt.
No t-shirt.
Yeah.
That brings us to path two, the size test.
Wait, FANRA provides a catch-all category for situations exactly like that. It simply states any other person.
Any other person.
Yes, but for this broad category, whether it's a natural person like our entrepreneur Ingrid, a private corporation, or a partnership they have to meet a strict mathematical threshold to get in.
And what's a magic number?
They must have total assets of at least $50 million to qualify as an institutional account.
So the bouncer stops Ingrid. She doesn't have the staff shirt. To get into the VIP tent, she literally has to pull out documentation proving she has $50 million in total assets. And if she has $49.9 million, the bouncer points her right back to the standard retail line.
He absolutely does. But let me stop you there to highlight a very specific, heavily tested nuance regarding that $50 million mark.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love exam traps. Hit me.
The rule specifically says total assets. It does not say net worth.
Whoa. Okay, I actually didn't catch that. Why does that matter?
Think about a highly leveraged real estate firm. Let's say Ingrid's company owns $55 million worth of commercial properties. Those are their assets.
Okay.
But they might also have $50 million in mortgages and debt on those properties.
Oh, so their actual net worth is only $5 million.
Exactly. So do they qualify as an institutional account under Path 2?
Well, by the letter of the law,
Yeah.
yes, because their total assets are over 50 million, even though their net worth is tiny compared to that.
They absolutely qualify. The regulatory test looks at the raw size of the asset base being managed. The assumption is that anyone juggling $50 million in physical assets, regardless of the debt side of the balance sheet, has enough financial complexity to require sophisticated internal controls.
Basically, if you can borrow 50 million, you can fend for yourself.
Exactly. Finaro says you don't need our retail protection.
That is a massive distinction. Total assets, not net worth. But, this brings up a trap. I've seen trip up so many people's dating for the 82.
Oh, yeah, the combo trap.
Yes. Listener, I am talking directly to you right now. Put your thinking cap on. I want you to actively pause and answer this in your head before we tell you.
Listen carefully.
Imagine Riley the rep is trying to open an account for a tiny local community bank. This bank is struggling. They only have $2 million in total assets.
2 million.
Right. So they walk up, the bouncer stops them. Are they an institutional account? Think about the two paths we just talked about.
Give them a second to think.
Okay, what's the verdict?
The community bank is unconditionally an institutional account.
Unconditionally.
Yeah.
Even with a measly $2 million in total assets.
Yes. The $50 million test only applies to the catch-all any other person category. Remember the t-shirt?
Right, path one.
A bank is a financial institution. They belong to path one. They are wearing the staff t-shirt. Therefore, they qualify as institutional regardless of how small their asset base shrinks.
Oh, that is devious. Test writers love to dangle a small dollar amount next to a bank or an insurance company, don't they?
They do it constantly to bait you into applying the $50 million test where it doesn't belong.
Wow. So if it's a bank, an insurance company, a mutual fund, or an RIA,
Yeah.
just ignore the dollar amount. They are VIPs.
Correct.
But if it's literally anyone else, a normal person, a regular corporation, you demand to see 50 million in total assets.
You have the mechanics down perfectly.
Okay, so why does Riley even care? Like, why is he so desperate to prove Ingrid is an institutional client? What is the actual tangible benefit of getting past this velvet rope?
The benefit is the elimination of friction.
Friction.
Institutional accounts are granted sweeping exemptions from some of the most tedious, time-consuming retail protection rules. For instance, the firm does not have to keep a record identifying the specific associated person responsible for the account.
Oh, nice.
They are also entirely exempt from the requirement to obtain a trusted contact person. Furthermore, they bypass several of the reasonable efforts, information gathering mandates that can totally stall the onboarding of a normal retail client.
So it essentially cuts Riley's paperwork burden in half. He doesn't have to hold their hand.
It allows the transaction to move at the speed of institutional business rather than the speed of retail compliance.
That makes total sense. Now let's pivot the scenario slightly. Let's say Riley has figured out Ingrid's classification. But during their meeting, Ingrid looks at her watch, sighs, and says, "Look, Riley, I am running three companies. I do not have time to review every single prospectus you send me. I trust you. Just handle my money and do what you think is best."
Oh. Well, that phrase instantly triggers a massive shift in regulatory liability.
Because we're entering discretion territory.
Exactly.
That.
We are now navigating the rules surrounding a discretionary account. A discretionary account exists when the member firm acting through a representative like Riley is legally authorized to exercise investment discretion for the customer.
So, in practical terms, this means Riley can decide what security to buy, what security to sell, or the specific quantity without asking Ingrid first.
Right. Without securing her explicit permission immediately before executing the trade.
He's basically flying the plane.
He is flying the plane, and because he is at the controls, Finrod demands a very specific paper trail.
What do they need?
For a discretionary account, the customer account information rule mandates that the firm must maintain a record of the dated signature of each associated person who is authorized to exercise discretion in that account.
Okay, so Riley's dated signature goes into the file cabinet. Simple enough. But here is where my ADHD brain starts finding loopholes.
Oh, here we go.
What if Ingrid says something that sounds like discretion but isn't? Let's say she calls Riley and says, "Riley, I want you to sell my entire position of 500 shares of XYZ stock today. I'm done with it."
Right.
But you just watch the market ticker and you pull the trigger whenever you think the price is at its absolute peak today. Is that a discretionary account?
No, that is not a discretionary account under the regulatory definition.
Really? But he's deciding when to trade.
Yes, but you are describing a very specific, limited carve-out known as time and price discretion. The record-keeping duty, that requirement to have Riley's dated signature on file, does not apply if the customer's grant of discretion is strictly limited to the price at which, or the time when, an order is executed.
Why the carve-out? Why is time and price safer than full discretion?
Consider the mechanism of control. For an order to avoid being classified as fully discretionary, the customer must independently specify the three core pillars of the trade.
Okay, what are the three pillars?
The specific asset, the action, and the amount. In your scenario, Ingrid chose the asset, right?
Yeah, XYZ stock.
She chose the action.
To sell.
And she chose the amount.
500 shares.
Right. She made all the fundamental investment decisions. She merely outsourced the intraday timing to Riley's execution expertise. Because the scope of Riley's power is so incredibly narrow, it doesn't trigger the heavy discretionary account rules.
But if Ingrid just says, hey, Riley, buy me 500 shares of whatever tech stock looks good today. She gave the action and the amount, but she left the asset up to Riley.
And the absolute second Riley chooses the asset, he is exercising true discretion. The dated signature must be on file.
I love that. Asset, action, amount.
Mm-hmm.
If Riley picks any of those three, he needs his signature in the file.
Yes.
But I need to throw a massive flashing warning light up right now for everyone listening. Listener, focus on this because it is the number one reason people fail this specific subtopic.
It's a huge trap.
Do not, under any circumstances, confuse the record-keeping duty we just talked about, which is simply having Riley's dated signature sitting quietly in a file folder with the actual compliance approval process required to exercise discretion.
I am so glad you're hammering this point. The exam completely relies on that exact confusion. There's a completely separate FINRA rule that governs how discretion is legally granted in the first place. That rule requires a separate written authorization from the customer and a formal written acceptance by a firm principal before Riley is allowed to execute a single discretionary trade.
Exactly. And the exam will try to play this semantic trick on you. The question will ask, under the customer account information rule, what record must be maintained for a discretionary account? And option A will be the customer's written authorization. Option B will be the dated signature of the associated person.
And thousands of test takers will choose option A because it sounds like the most important document.
It sounds like the right answer.
But the specific rule being tested, the account record rule, only asks for the associated person's signature. The customer's authorization belongs to an entirely different chapter of the compliance manual. You have to answer the specific question being asked. Keep the record-keeping rule strictly contained in its own box.
Okay, so Riley has determined if Ingrid is a VIP, and he knows whether he's flying the plane or just taking orders. We are finally ready to gather the actual physical data required to open this account.
Time for the paperwork.
And the regulators don't just say, hey, get some info. They provide an unforgiving checklist. Let's look at the foundational data requirements.
The customer account information framework is structured in two distinct tiers. The first tier is the absolute baseline. This is information the firm must mandatorily maintain for every single applicable account.
So if you don't have these items, the onboarding process hits a brick wall.
Exactly. The second tier is a softer category of information that the firm must genuinely attempt to obtain, but it isn't an absolute gatekeeper if the customer is uncooperative.
Let's start with tier one. The mandatory list. I call these the golden tickets. There are six of them. I'll read off the straightforward ones and then let's dissect the complicated ones.
Sounds good.
Number one, the customer's name and residence, basic identification. Number two, legal age status. Are they legally an adult capable of signing a contract?
Easy enough.
Number three, the name of the associated person or persons responsible for the account.
Let's pause on number three. If a team of brokers is managing the account, the record must clearly delineate the scope of each person's responsibility. The regulators want to know exactly who's neck to ring if something goes wrong.
Right, accountability.
However, recall our velvet rope discussion. If Ingrid's account is an institutional account, this specific requirement is waived.
Ah, the VIP perks in action, I remember.
No.
Okay, number four, authorized representatives. If Ingrid isn't opening a personal account, but rather an account for her corporation or a partnership, Riley must collect the names of any individuals legally authorized to transact business on behalf of that entity.
Yep.
Number five is where things get treacherous. The signature of the principal, partner, or officer. Basically, Sam, the sponsor, has to sign the account record. Now, if I am an outsider looking at this and I see Sam's signature on Ingrid's file, my immediate assumption is that Sam is watching every single trade Riley makes for Ingrid.
Which makes sense logically.
Right. He signed off on it, so he owns it, right?
That assumption is incredibly common, completely logical, and entirely wrong in the eyes of Finora.
Oh, wow. Oh.
That is a primary exam trap. The principal's signature requirement at account opening does only one thing. It establishes that a principal of the firm reviewed the paperwork and accepted the account in accordance with the firm's specific written policies for opening accounts.
Wait, so acceptance is completely detached from supervision?
Completely detached. Think about the logistics of a major broker-dealer. Sam might be signing 300 account opening forms a day.
He never sleeps.
Exactly. He is just verifying that the KYC data is present, that the identity is verified, and that the account fits the firm's risk parameters. He is not magically binding himself to review every single transaction Riley executes in that account for the next 10 years.
So who is supervising?
The firm has a separate, ongoing systemic duty to supervise the account's activity, usually handled by algorithmic surveillance and specialized compliance teams. Do not let a multiple choice question trick you into equating a day one onboarding signature with perpetual granular supervisory review.
That is such a vital distinction. Acceptance is just opening the door. Supervision is watching the room. Got it.
Perfect way to remember it.
Let's move to the sixth and final mandatory item. The trusted contact person. Riley needs to ask Ingrid for the name and contact information of a person age 18 or older who may be contacted about the account. Again, this doesn't apply to institutional VIPs. But for retail Ingrid, Riley has to ask.
He absolutely must ask.
Why? Is this like a power of attorney? If Ingrid goes into a coma, can this trusted contact call Riley and say, sell everything and buy gold?
No, absolutely not. A trusted contact person has zero authority to execute trades, move money, or alter the account.
Okay, so what can they do?
Think of the trusted contact provision as a regulatory permission slip that the firm secures in advance. It was introduced relatively recently as a specific countermeasure against the rising tide of elder financial exploitation.
Oh, that makes sense. How does it work in practice?
Okay, if Riley notices that Ingrid, who has been a conservative investor for 20 years, suddenly requests a wire transfer of $500,000 to an unknown offshore entity.
Major red flag.
Right. And she sounds confused or frightened on the phone, Riley is in a terrible bind. Privacy laws generally prohibit him from discussing Ingrid's account with a third party.
He can't just call her family.
Exactly. But if he has a trusted contact on file, say, Ingrid's adult daughter, the disclosure she signed on day one permits Riley to call the daughter. He can legally say, I am deeply concerned about a transaction your mother is trying to make. Is she okay? Is someone pressuring her?
Oh, so it's a break glass in case of emergency contact.
Precisely. It also legally shields the firm if they need to apply Finora's temporary hold rule, which allows a firm to freeze disbursements from an account if they strongly suspect financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. The trusted contact provides a safe harbor for the firm to communicate during a crisis without violating privacy statutes.
I love the intent behind it. But here is the reality of human behavior. Listener, it is time for another direct question.
Here we go.
Riley is sitting across the mahogany desk from Ingrid. He explains this rule beautifully. He asks for her adult daughter's name. And Ingrid, who is fiercely independent and highly paranoid about her privacy, flat out refuses.
No way!
Exactly. She crosses her arms and says, absolutely not, Riley. It is my money. I don't want my daughter or anyone else knowing a single thing about my finances. Skip that line.
Okay.
Can Riley still open the account? Remember, this is on the list of the six mandatory items. Think about it.
Pause for a second.
What does Riley do?
Riley can proceed and open the account.
Wait, even though she refused the mandatory item? Why have a rule if I said no is a valid excuse?
Because the regulators had to balance the desire to protect vulnerable adults against the reality that you cannot force a stubborn citizen to surrender third-party information just to access the financial markets. So the rule contains a very specific softener. The absence of a trusted contact person's name does not prevent the firm from opening or maintaining the account, provided the firm makes reasonable efforts to obtain it.
Ah, reasonable efforts. The magic words.
Yes. If Riley asks for the contact, explains clearly why it is beneficial and how it is used, and meticulously documents in his notes that Ingrid definitively refused, Riley has satisfied the regulatory requirement.
So the mandate is the effort to educate and obtain, not the absolute presence of the data in the file.
Exactly. The effort is the requirement.
That perfectly bridges us to the second tier of information. We have the six mandatory items, with the trusted contact having that reasonable efforts escape hatch. Now let's look at the pure reasonable efforts tier. What else does Riley have to try to get?
For every retail account, the firm must make reasonable efforts to obtain three specific pieces of information. And critically, the deadline for this effort is not when the account is opened.
When is it?
The effort must be made prior to the settlement of the initial transaction in the account.
Before settlement, not before opening. That timeline creates some bizarre situations. What are the three items?
Number one, the customer's tax identification or social security number. Number two, the customer's occupation and the name and address of their employer. Number three, whether the customer is an associated person of another FINRA member firm.
Let's paint an absurd scenario to visualize this timeline, because my ADHD brain needs a story to lock in the phrase prior to settlement.
I love your scenarios. Let's hear it.
Okay. It is Monday morning. Riley opens Ingrid's account. He asks for her occupation and her employer's address. Ingrid says, "I'm in a rush. I'll tell you later." And she sprints out of the office.
Okay. Account is technically open.
Right. On Tuesday morning, Ingrid calls and screams, "Buy 10,000 shares of Apple right now." Riley executes the trade. Under standard rules, that equity trade settles on Wednesday.
T plus one. Yep.
So it is now Tuesday night. Riley is sitting in his car in his driveway, sweating profusely, panic dialing Ingrid's cell phone, shouting into the voicemail, "Ingrid, where do you work? I need an address before tomorrow morning or I'm in violation." Is that ridiculous scenario technically how the rule operates?
It is entirely absurd, but it is technically accurate under FINRA rules.
That is hilarious.
Occupation, employer, and associated person status are information-gathering targets designed to help the firm monitor for insider trading and conflicts of interest. They are not strict gatekeepers that freeze the mechanical opening of the account.
Got it.
A customer who delays providing them doesn't block the account from functioning, so long as the firm can demonstrate they made reasonable, documented efforts to extract that data before that first trade officially settles and the money actually moves.
Okay, I am with you.
I
feel a trap coming. There is a massive structural exception hiding in that list of three things.
You have a good instinct for traps. There is a monumental exception, and it revolves around the taxpayer identification number for a U.S. person.
Right. Because while the FINRA rule we are currently discussing casually says reasonable efforts before settlement, there is an entirely different, incredibly powerful set of federal rules that completely overrides it. I am talking about the Customer Identification Program, or CIP, rules.
Yes. Let's contextualize this, because understanding the history makes the rule unforgettable. The CIP rules were born out of the USA Patriot Act in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks.
Right. Massive shift in regulation.
Exactly. The federal government realized that terrorist networks were utilizing the U.S. financial system because brokerages weren't rigorously verifying identities. The mandate came down from the Treasury Department: know your customer.
KYC.
You must form a reasonable belief that you know the true identity of every single person opening an account.
And the absolute linchpin of proving identity in the United States is the Social Security number, or tax ID.
Exactly. Because of the anti-money laundering and anti-terrorism imperatives of the CIP rules, the requirement for a U.S. person's tax ID is violently pulled forward in the timeline.
Wait, violently pulled forward?
Yes. FINRA might say reasonable efforts before settlement, but the federal CIP rules scream mandatory requirement before account opening.
So the federal law trumps the FINRA rule.
Always. Under CIP, you must secure the name, date of birth, physical address, and tax ID prior to opening the account.
No exceptions.
The only narrow exception allowed under CIP is if the customer has formally applied for a tax ID and is actively waiting for the government to process it, in which case the firm must obtain it within a reasonable period after opening. But practically speaking, for a standard U.S. citizen, if there is no Social Security number, there's no account.
Wow. So on the exam, you really have to read the question with a magnifying glass.
You do.
Because if they ask about the deadline for obtaining the customer's occupation and employer address, the answer is reasonable efforts prior to settlement.
Yep.
But if they ask about the deadline for a U.S. person's tax ID, the answer is prior to account opening due to CIP.
That is the exact differentiation the test writers are looking for. They love to mix those up.
Incredible. Okay, let's fast forward. Riley survived the onboarding gauntlet. Ingrid's account is officially open. The signatures are filed. The identity is verified. The trades are flowing. Everything is perfect.
Smooth sailing.
But human lives are not static. People get married. They change jobs. They move across the country. Accounts are living things. Which brings us to a massive regulatory headache. Living accounts and the paper trail. What happens to the compliance framework when the underlying facts change?
The overarching principle is that account records are not insects trapped in amber, frozen forever on the day they were signed. FINRA/I dictates that anything that alters the foundational facts the firm relied upon to open the account triggers an immediate duty to update the record.
And is that just for big stuff?
No, this duty reaches far beyond merely fixing a typo in a zip code. A material change to any required account record item, whether it is a new physical address, an updated tax ID due to a corporate restructuring, or a change in the associated person responsible for the account, creates an affirmative obligation for the firm to formally update its central record.
Okay, let's talk about legacy accounts, because the rules change over time. FINRA adds new requirements, like the trusted contact rule we just talked about.
Right.
Let's say Ingrid opened a massive brokerage account 20 years ago, long before the trust and contact rule even existed. For two decades, she just buys and holds blue chip stocks. She rarely talks to Riley. Are Sam, the sponsor, and the compliance department having a panic attack because her 20-year-old file is technically non-compliant with modern rules?
Sam can sleep soundly for the moment.
Really?
Yes. This introduces a concept I like to call the touch rule. FINRA recognizes that forcing firms to retroactively hunt down millions of clients to update decades-old paperwork would paralyze the industry.
It would be a nightmare.
So a firm is not required to proactively drag an account, which was legally opened under a prior set of rules, into full compliance with current modern requirements until the firm updates that account's information.
It's like a sleeping bear in a cave. As long as you don't poke it, it won't bother you.
Exactly. The legacy account is perfectly fine remaining in its historical state as long as the underlying client facts remain identical. But the moment Ingrid calls Riley and says, "Hey, I finally sold my house in New York and moved to a condo in Florida. Please update my address."
She just poked the bear.
She just poked the bear.
Because the firm has to physically touch her file to change the address.
Yes. And once they touch that file in the ordinary course of business, the grandfathered status evaporates completely. Touching the file forces the firm to bring the entire account fully into current modern compliance.
And practically, what does that usually trigger?
The most common trigger involves the trusted contact person disclosure. If you touch a legacy account to update an address or an employer, the firm must simultaneously deliver the written trusted contact disclosure to the customer and make reasonable efforts to obtain a name, because that is a modern requirement that was likely missing from the original 20-year-old paperwork.
Okay, that makes sense for a customer-driven change. Ingrid chose to move to Florida, but what about a firm-driven change?
What do you mean?
Let's say Riley has been crushing it. He gets promoted to regional manager. He can no longer handle day-to-day retail accounts.
Good for Riley.
Right. The firm decides to reassign Ingrid's account to a brand new, hungry rep named Dave. Ingrid didn't do anything. The firm just shuffled the deck. Is that a big deal?
It is a significant regulatory event.
Really? Just moving it from desk A to desk B internally?
Yes. Remember one of our six mandatory golden tickets. The record must identify the associated person responsible for the account.
Oh, right.
If you change the person, you must formally update the account record to reflect the new identity, and that updated record must be approved. The regulators always demand to know exactly who is sitting in the pilot seat on any given day.
Okay, here is where this gets incredibly granular and frankly kind of fascinating if you are a regulatory nerd. When we talk about updating records, we are inevitably forced to talk about how long the firm has to keep the old replaced records. We have to examine the 6-year retention clocks.
The language is paramount here. The SEC and FINRA rules utilize two very distinct verbs to describe two entirely different states of the exact same piece of information. Maintain and preserve.
Maintain and preserve.
Do not conflate them.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison. Let's return to our scenario where Ingrid moves from New York to Florida. She calls Riley today and gives him the new Florida address. What happens?
First, the firm updates the active living account record with the new Florida address. The firm is required to maintain this current active information as long as the account is open.
Okay, but what happens to the old New York address? It doesn't just get deleted, right?
No, definitely not. The rule states that the firm must preserve the old replaced, record the dead information for at least 6 years after the date it was updated.
Direct question for you, listener. Let's lock this timeline in.
Listen close.
If Ingrid changes her address from New York to Florida today, when does the 6-year regulatory clock start ticking for the firm to hold on to her old New York address? Does it start when she opened the account 10 years ago? Does it start today? Or does it start when she eventually closes the account?
Give them the beat.
Break it down for us.
The clock starts today. The 6-year retention period for replaced information runs from the date of the update.
So she opened the account in 2015, lived in New York for 11 years, and changed her address to Florida in 2026. The firm has to keep the 2015 New York address on file until 2032. 6 years from the moment it was replaced.
Correct. That is the timeline for preserving dead data. But what about the final, ultimate state of the account?
Right. What if Ingrid gets fed up with the markets, calls Riley and says, sell everything, wire me the cash, and close the account?
But at the moment the account is closed, the final snapshot of the information, the last updated address, or the original information, if it was remarkably never updated over its lifespan, must be kept for at least 6 years after the date the account is closed.
So we maintain the active final record for 6 years after the account dies. We preserve the dead, replaced records for 6 years after they were swapped out.
It sounds like semantics, but test writers exploit it. Maintain the living final state, preserve the dead historical states. Both run on a 6-year clock, but the trigger for the clock is entirely different.
That is a phenomenal way to conceptualize it. Maintain the living, preserve the dead.
All right, take a deep breath.
Why? What's next?
We're going to take a very dark turn.
Oh.
Riley has been a good boy. He has maintained perfect records. His 6-year clocks are flawless. He knows exactly who is in the VIP line.
Sounds good so far.
But Riley recommends a highly complex, illiquid private placement to Ingrid. He thinks it's a slam dunk. Instead, the underlying company goes bankrupt. The investment goes to zero. Ingrid loses $5 million.
Oh, that's a nightmare. She is furious. The trust is gone. She hires a shark of an attorney. She wants blood. She wants to take Riley and the entire firm to federal court, put them in front of a jury of 12 sympathetic citizens, and sue them for every penny they have.
Standard litigation response.
But before she can even file the lawsuit, Sam, the sponsor, calmly opens her pristine, meticulously maintained file folder and pulls out a single piece of paper from day one. It is the pre-dispute arbitration agreement. Welcome to Fight Club. Let's talk about arbitration.
This is where the theoretical paperwork suddenly becomes a profoundly powerful legal weapon.
How so?
A pre-dispute arbitration agreement is a document that asks a customer to voluntarily surrender their constitutional right to a civil court trial and their right to a jury before any dispute or anger even exists. They sign it on day one when everyone is drinking coffee, smiling, and optimistic about making money.
You are asking someone to sign away their fundamental rights before they even know they are going to be wronged. That feels inherently dangerous. I assume the regulators do not take that lightly.
They take it incredibly seriously. Because of that massive preemptive waiver of rights, the pre-dispute arbitration disclosure rule is one of the most prescriptive, heavily mandated rules in the entire Fee and Raw handbook.
It's locked down.
It is. It loads the agreement with mandatory warnings, strict delivery deadlines, and hard, immovable limits on what the brokerage firm can actually force the client to accept.
Let's examine the warnings. If I'm drafting this agreement for my firm, I can't just hide a sentence in paragraph 40 that says, hey, by the way, if we fight, we go to arbitration, right?
Absolutely not.
The rules mandate that the arbitration clause must be highlighted, and it must be immediately preceded by a disclosure statement in a very specific mandated format. The rule basically spoon-feeds you the exact outline you must print.
Yeah, they don't leave room for creativity.
There are 7 required warnings. Let's walk through the heavy hitters.
First and foremost, you must bluntly inform them that all parties are giving up the right to sue each other in court, including the explicit waiver of the right to a jury trial.
Pretty straightforward.
Second, you must warn them that arbitration awards are generally final and binding. A court's ability to review, reverse, or modify an arbitration award is vanishingly small. If the arbitrator rules against you, it is practically over.
Warning number 3 deals with logistics. Discovery, which is the legal process of demanding documents, emails, and witness depositions, is generally far more limited in arbitration than it is in a sprawling federal court case. You can't just subpoena every single employee at the firm for a fishing expedition.
Very true.
Warning number 4 is fascinating to me. Arbitrators do not have to explain the reasons for their award. A jury or a judge usually provides a ruling or an opinion. An arbitration panel can just hand out a piece of paper that says Riley's firm must pay Ingrid $2 million and offer absolutely zero explanation as to how they arrived at that math.
Let me interject right there, because you just walked into a massive exception that the Series 82 absolutely loves to test.
Really?
You stated that arbitrators do not have to explain the awards. Generally, that is true. But there is a very specific, highly testable carve-out the 20-day rule.
Okay, how does a client force an explanation?
Arbitrators are not required to explain the reasons for an award unless all parties to the arbitration jointly request an explained decision. Furthermore, this joint request must be submitted to the panel at least 20 days before the first scheduled hearing date.
Wait, hold on. All parties jointly request?
Yes.
Let's play this out. Ingrid just lost $5 million. She goes through the arbitration grinder. She desperately wants an explained decision so her lawyers can understand exactly why she lost or won, maybe to find a tiny sliver of hope for an appeal. She files a demand for an explanation.
Makes sense for her.
But Riley and the firm's lawyers look at it and say, nah, we don't want to establish any kind of written precedent. We decline. Does Ingrid get the explanation?
She gets absolutely nothing.
Wow. So one side holding out vetoes the whole thing?
That is correct. A request from only one side does not trigger the mandate for an explained decision. It must be unanimous among the parties.
That's a huge hurdle.
And critically, pay attention to the timeline. The clock is measured as 20 days before the first scheduled hearing date, not 20 days after filing the claim, and not 20 days before the end of the trial. The test will try to confuse those anchor points.
Why is the system built like that? Why wouldn't they want explanations by default?
Because the entire philosophical purpose of arbitration is efficiency and finality. Writing a detailed, legally sound 30-page opinion takes time and costs money.
And creates a paper trail for appeals.
More importantly, yes. Detailed explanations provide a roadmap for the losing side to attempt an appeal in civil court, arguing that the arbitrator misapplied the law. By issuing a simple dollar figure without explanation, the panel makes the award nearly bulletproof against appeal. The system prioritizes closure over transparency.
That is brutal, but it makes perfect logical sense when you explain the mechanics. Let's quickly hit the rest of the seven warnings.
Go for it.
Number 5. The customer must be warned that the arbitration panel might include a minority of arbitrators who were or are affiliated with the securities industry, meaning you might have industry insiders judging your claim against the industry.
Yep.
Number 6. The rules of the arbitration forum dictate strict time limits for bringing a claim. And number 7. The specific rules of the arbitration forum are explicitly incorporated into the agreement.
Beyond the content of those 7 points, FERA enforces a strict formatting requirement. A prominently highlighted statement must appear immediately before the customer's signature line.
So they can't miss it.
Exactly. This statement must explicitly warn that the agreement contains an arbitration clause, and it must specifically identify the exact page and paragraph where that clause is located. You are legally forbidden from burying this in the fine print on page 36.
So Ingrid reads the warnings, she accepts the reality, and she signs the agreement. Now the burden shifts back to Riley and the firm. We have 2 delivery clocks to keep straight, and the exam is going to try to tangle them up in a word problem.
Let's do another side-by-side comparison.
Perfect.
Clock number 1 is the unprompted delivery requirement. Within 30 days of the customer signing the agreement, the firm must proactively provide the customer with a copy of the finalized signed agreement, and the firm must secure the customer's acknowledgement of receipt.
So Riley has a 30-day window to send the fully executed copy to Ingrid, even if she never asks for it.
Yeah.
It is an automatic duty.
Correct. Clock number 2 is the on-request delivery requirement. If the customer specifically requests a copy of the agreement, the firm is obligated to provide it within 10 business days of receiving that request.
Okay, let me challenge you with an overlap scenario. I want to see how these clocks interact.
Let's hear it.
Let's say Ingrid signs the massive stack of account forms on day 1. On day 5, she calls Riley and says, hey, my lawyer wants to see that arbitration thing I signed. Can you send me a copy?
Okay, a request on day 5.
Riley is busy. He looks at his calendar. He knows he has the 30-day unprompted window. He thinks, well, she asked on day 5, and I have 10 business days to respond to a request, so I have until day 15. But does her specific request buy him an extra 10 days, or does it compress his original 30-day window?
If the customer's request arrives before the firm has satisfied the unprompted 30-day delivery requirement, the firm must meet whichever of the 2 deadlines falls earlier.
Ah. So because she asked on day 5, the 10 business day clock triggers immediately. Riley must deliver it within those 10 business days. He cannot rely on the original 30-day window anymore because the 10-day clock will expire first. Whichever is earlier wins.
Exactly. The firm can never use one rule to delay the rights granted by another rule.
Makes sense.
Now, we must transition to the restrictions placed on the firms. We need to discuss what a firm can never force a client to agree to. These are the never include conditions.
Right. Because if left to their own devices, corporate lawyers would just write a one-sentence agreement that says, you can never sue us for anything, ever, under any circumstances.
Oh, they absolutely would. But FINRA puts guardrails up. A pre-dispute arbitration agreement may not include any condition that limits or contradicts the rules of any self-regulatory organization like FINRA.
Okay.
It cannot limit a party's ability to file any claim in arbitration. It cannot limit a party's ability to file in court a claim that the forum's rules otherwise explicitly permit to go to court. And crucially, it cannot contain any language that limits the arbitrator's ability to make an award, including punitive damages if they are warranted.
You can't cap the downside.
You cannot kneecap the arbitrator's authority.
And there is one massive, highly tested carve-out that every single agreement must explicitly state in plain text. The class action carve-out.
This is a vital protection. Every agreement must explicitly state that no person shall bring a putative or certified class action to arbitration, nor shall any person seek to enforce a pre-dispute arbitration agreement against any customer who has initiated a class action in court.
Let's translate that into our scenario. Ingrid realizes that the terrible private placement Riley sold her wasn't just sold to her. Riley sold it to 5,000 different retail investors. And they all lost money. A massive class action lawsuit is filed in federal court against Riley's firm. Ingrid joins the class action.
Yeah.
Riley's lawyers scramble. They pull out Ingrid's file. They find her arbitration agreement. Can Riley go to the federal judge and say, hold on, Your Honor. Ingrid signed an arbitration agreement. She is not allowed to be in this court case. We demand you extract her and force her to arbitrate with us individually behind closed doors.
The judge will laugh Riley's lawyers out of the courtroom. If Ingrid is part of a putative or certified class action, she is completely protected from being forced into individual arbitration.
So the arbitration agreement is essentially neutralized.
It is neutralized temporarily.
Temporarily.
The agreement remains dormant unless one of three specific things happens. The court denies class certification, the class is subsequently decertified, or Ingrid is formally excluded from the class. If she's no longer protected by the umbrella of the class action, that arbitration agreement instantly wakes right back up and she is bound by it once again.
That is fascinating. The class action operates as a temporary shield against arbitration.
Okay.
Let's play out the ultimate all or nothing scenario regarding arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
This is high level litigation strategy and FINRA has a very specific rule for it.
Let's do it.
Ingrid decides to sue Riley and the firm in court. She doesn't join a class action. She just files a massive individual lawsuit. She hires a very creative, aggressive lawyer. This lawyer drafts a sprawling complaint with five different claims.
Okay, five claims.
Let's say three of those claims are standard securities fraud claims that are clearly covered by the arbitration agreement. But the lawyer also throws in two wild, esoteric claims, maybe a bizarre state-level defamation claim and a weird property dispute that are somehow not covered by the wording of the arbitration clause.
Lawyers love doing that.
Riley's legal team looks at this. They want the home field advantage. They want to pull the three covered claims into arbitration because it's friendlier for the firm. They don't care about the other two. Direct question to you, the listener. Can Riley split the lawsuit?
Think about it.
Can he compel the three covered claims into the arbitration forum and leave Ingrid to fight the other two claims in civil court?
What happens when the firm tries to divide and conquer?
No.
The firm is prohibited from splitting the claims if the customer objects. The rule is absolute. If the firm seeks to compel arbitration on the covered claims and the customer demands it, the firm must agree to arbitrate every single claim contained in the complaint, even the ones that weren't originally covered by the agreement.
Wait, so if the firm tries to pull Ingrid into arbitration on the three claims, Ingrid can turn around and say, fine, but you have to arbitrate all five claims together.
Exactly. It is an all or nothing choice for the firm, dictated at the customer's option. FINRA recognizes that forcing a retail customer to fight a two-front war paying lawyers to simultaneously battle in arbitration and in civil court over the same underlying dispute is an unbearable financial burden designed to bankrupt the client into settling.
Wow. So if you pull them into Fight Club, you have to fight them on everything? You can't cherry-pick the battles?
You must consume the entire lawsuit if you want the benefit of the arbitration forum.
That is a brilliant piece of regulatory leverage for the customer. Okay, let's take a breath and reset the board. Ingrid and Riley finally settle their massive arbitration dispute.
Yeah.
The dust settles, Ingrid takes her remaining funds, and she is ready to invest again. But this time, she takes off her retail investor hat. She is no longer just Ingrid, the wealthy individual. She puts on a very different, very heavy corporate hat. She is now acting as the trustee representing her manufacturing company's massive private sector employee benefit plan. She is responsible for the retirement money of 2,000 factory workers. We are leaving the standard FINRA rulebook behind. We are entering Section 5. We are facing the final boss of financial regulation.
Welcome to the realm of ERISA.
ERISA.
If you want to understand the modern financial world, you must understand ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. It is arguably the most powerful, unforgiving piece of financial legislation in American history.
To understand why ERISA is so terrifying to financial professionals, we really have to understand why it exists. The regulators didn't just wake up one day and decide to invent a nightmare of fiduciary rules. What happened?
We have to look at the history, specifically the Studebaker collapse.
Studebaker, the car company.
Yes. In 1963, the Studebaker Automobile Company shut down its manufacturing plant in South Bend, Indiana. At the time, pensions were essentially just promises made by a company. There was no real federal protection. Studebaker had severely underfunded its pension plan. When the company collapsed, the pension just vanished.
Oof, gone.
Over 4,000 workers, people who had spent 30 years on an assembly line believing their retirement was secure, were told they would receive pennies on the dollar or absolutely nothing.
It was an absolute localized economic apocalypse. People lost everything.
It was a national scandal. It exposed the horrifying reality that the retirement security of the American working class was entirely unprotected. Congress spent a decade investigating, and the result was ERISA.
And what was the goal?
ERISA was built with singular, ruthless intent to protect the retirement assets of private sector workers by imposing incredibly strict, uncompromising fiduciary duties on the people who manage that money.
Okay, so ERISA is the shield for the private sector worker. But for the exam, it is equally crucial to know what ERISA does not cover. Where does its power stop?
There are specific plan types that fall entirely outside of ERISA's jurisdiction. The two most heavily tested exemptions, the massive exam traps, are government plans and church plans.
Let's bring Riley back. Riley survived arbitration, and he is hustling for new institutional business. He goes down to City Hall. He gets a meeting with the city manager who controls the local municipal workers' pension fund, the retirement money for the police, the firefighters, the teachers.
Okay, a municipal fund.
Riley walks in, drops a massive 1,000-page binder on ERISA compliance on the desk, and starts intensely lecturing the city manager about how his firm can help them navigate ERISA-prohibited transactions.
Riley's making a fool of himself and entirely wasting his breath.
Why?
Government plans, which are plans established or maintained for its employees by the government of the United States, by the government of any state, or by any political subdivision like a local municipality, are entirely statutorily exempt from ERISA. They operate under their own state or local statutory frameworks.
The federal government essentially said, states, you manage your own pensions, we won't interfere.
Exactly. The same broad exemption applies to church plans, which are established for employees of a church or by a convention of churches, unless the church specifically and voluntarily elects to be covered by ERISA.
Are there any other minor exemptions to watch out for?
Three others. Workers' compensation, unemployment, or disability plans maintained solely to comply with applicable state laws. Non-U.S. plans maintained outside the United States primarily for the benefit of non-resident aliens. And finally, unfunded excess benefit plans, which are essentially just non-qualified top hat plans designed to give highly compensated executives benefits above the standard IRS tax limits.
So if Ingrid is managing the pension for her private sector factory workers, we are squarely inside ERISA. Which brings us to the most dangerous, highly litigated word in modern finance, fiduciary.
The F word.
Under ERISA, who exactly wears the fiduciary hat? Because it seems like everyone wants to avoid it.
They want to avoid it because the liability is personal and devastating. Under ERISA, fiduciary status is not necessarily a title you are given. It is a functional test based on your actions. A person is a fiduciary to the extent they meet certain behavioral tests. We must break this down because there is a massive legal chasm between having actual discretion over money and merely giving advice about money.
Let's examine the discretion test first. I call this test one.
Test one is automatic and undeniable. If you exercise any discretionary authority or discretionary control over the management of the plan, or if you exercise any authority or control over the management or disposition of the plan's assets, you are an ERISA fiduciary.
No gray area.
The millisecond you have the power to move the money without asking permission, the fiduciary hat is bolted to your head.
That is black and white. But what if Riley doesn't have control? What if he's just a broker trying to earn a commission? Let's say Riley takes Ingrid out for a very expensive steak dinner.
Okay, classic sales tactic.
Over dessert, he says, "Hey, Ingrid, you should really look at this new commercial real estate fund for the pension. I think it's going to double in 3 years." He doesn't have control. He just pitched an idea. Does that make him a fiduciary?
That specific scenario triggers test two, the Department of Labor's 5-part test for investment advice. To be deemed a fiduciary merely by giving advice for a fee, a person must meet all 5 prongs of this highly specific test. If you miss even one prong, you are just a salesman, not a fiduciary.
Okay, what are the 5 hurdles?
Prong 1. You render advice as to the value of securities or other property, or make recommendations as to the advisability of investing in, purchasing, or selling securities.
Okay.
Prong 2. This advice is provided on a regular basis. Prong 3. The advice is provided pursuant to a mutual agreement, arrangement, or understanding between the advisor and the plan.
A mutual understanding.
Right. Prong 4. The mutual understanding is that the plan will treat your advice as a primary basis for its investment decisions. And prong 5. The advice is individualized, tailored specifically to the particular needs of the plan.
Okay, I am throwing another pattern interrupt right here because this is a classic trap. Let's go back to the steak dinner.
Right.
Riley gave advice. That's prong 1. He told her it was good for the pension. That's prong 5. Does that one-off tip at a restaurant make Riley an ERISA fiduciary?
Absolutely not. Think about the mechanics of the test. A one-off tip completely fails prong 2. It was not on a regular basis.
Right.
Furthermore, it almost certainly fails prong 3 and prong 4, unless Riley and Ingrid had previously established a mutual understanding that she was going to base her massive pension allocations primarily on his casual dinner recommendations. He is not a fiduciary. All 5 prongs must interlock simultaneously.
So the regulators require a sustained, mutually understood relationship of reliance before they impose the fiduciary burden on an advisor.
Exactly.
Let's assume Riley actually clears the 5-part test. He signs a consulting contract. He meets with Ingrid monthly. She relies on him. He is officially an ERISA fiduciary. What does that actually mean for his day-to-day life? What is he legally forced to do?
It means his entire professional existence must now bow to the 4 fiduciary duties. And listener, if you memorize anything from this deep dive, memorize these 4 duties. And remember, these duties run exclusively to the plan participants, the factory workers, not to Ingrid, and certainly not to the corporation sponsoring the plan.
Hit me. Let's hear them.
Duty number 1, the exclusive purpose rule. A fiduciary must discharge their duties solely in the interest of the participants and beneficiaries for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits and defraying reasonable expenses of administering the plan.
Translate that for me.
You cannot make an investment decision because it helps the company's bottom line. You cannot make a decision because it generates a juicy commission for your firm. Every single action must be exclusively designed to benefit the factory worker retiring in 20 years.
Duty number 2.
Duty number 2. Prudence. A fiduciary must act with the care, skill, prudence, and diligence under the circumstances then prevailing that a prudent man acting in a like capacity and familiar with such matters would use.
Familiar with such matters.
Mm-mm.
I want to highlight that phrase because my understanding is that this isn't just asking you to be a careful, normal person.
Correct. This is legally interpreted as a prudent expert standard, not a prudent layperson standard. You cannot defend a terrible investment by going to court and saying, "Well, I tried my best. It seemed like a good idea to me."
What will the court say?
The court will say, "You accepted the fiduciary role. You are judged against what a highly trained, competent financial expert would have done in the same situation. If you don't possess the expertise to evaluate a complex derivative, it is a breach of prudence to invest in it."
That is terrifying.
Duty number 3, diversification. A fiduciary must diversify the investments of the plan so as to minimize the risk of large losses, unless, under the circumstances, it is clearly prudent not to do so. You cannot put 50% of the pension into a single tech stock.
Makes sense.
And duty number 4, follow plan documents. You must act in accordance with the specific documents and instruments governing the plan, provided they are consistent with the provisions of ERISA. You actually have to read the rule book the company wrote for itself.
So if Riley is bound by those 4 massive duties, his life is already hard. But ERISA adds an entire minefield on top of it called prohibited transactions. What is this?
ERISA operates on a very cynical but historically justified assumption. It assumes that certain relationships are just too fraught with inherent conflicts of interest to ever be fully trusted. Therefore, the law designates a broad group of people and entities as parties in interest.
Who gets labeled a party in interest?
Any fiduciary to the plan, any person or entity providing services to the plan, which absolutely includes Riley and his broker-dealer, the employer sponsoring the plan, the labor union representing the workers, and certain relatives or large shareholders of those entities.
Okay, so Riley's broker-dealer is a party in interest because they provide trading services. What does that mean? What can't they do?
Without securing a specific legal exemption, an ERISA fiduciary is strictly prohibited from causing the plan to engage in a transaction that constitutes a direct or indirect sale, exchange, or lease of property between the plan and a party in interest. They cannot lend money to them, they cannot furnish goods, services, or facilities to them, and they cannot transfer any plan assets to them.
Wait, hold on. If Riley's broker-dealer is a party in interest because they provide services, and providing services to a party in interest is a prohibited transaction, how can they legally work for the plan at all? That's a catch-22.
And that is exactly where the system of exemptions comes into play. Engaging in a transaction with a party in interest is not automatically illegal if you meet the rigorous criteria of a qualifying statutory or administrative exemption. For the Series 82, the most critical exemption to understand is the exemption for necessary services. The plan is allowed to contract or make reasonable arrangements with a party in interest for office space or for legal, accounting, or other services necessary for the establishment or operation of the plan, provided that no more than reasonable compensation is paid for those services.
Reasonable compensation. So Riley's firm can charge standard market rate commissions for executing trades, but they can't charge exorbitant hidden fees just because they have the relationship.
Precisely. If the compensation becomes unreasonable, the exemption vanishes, and it instantly reverts to a prohibited transaction, triggering massive excise taxes from the IRS and personal liability for the fiduciary.
Okay, let's tie this entire deep dive together with the ultimate highly tested exam scenario. We are going to combine the private placement aspect of the Series 82 with the ERISA rules.
The big finale.
Sam, the sponsor, has created a new, highly complex, deeply illiquid private equity fund. Riley pitches it to Ingrid for her massive factory worker pension plan. Why is selling Sam's illiquid private placement to Ingrid's ERISA plan such an absolute regulatory nightmare?
It is a nightmare for two entirely distinct reasons. The first reason is obvious based on the four duties we just discussed. Illiquidity constantly battles prudence and diversification.
Because it's hard to sell.
A private placement is, by its nature, hard to value. There is no daily ticker. It is also incredibly hard to sell if you need cash quickly. When a fiduciary is managing retirement money that must eventually be paid out to retirees, locking a massive chunk of that money into an illiquid, hard-to-value asset requires rigorous expert justification to satisfy the prudent expert and diversification duties. It is inherently risky.
But there's a second reason, right? A hidden structural trap that terrifies fund managers. We are talking about the plan assets question, also known as the 25% rule.
This is arguably the most complex mechanical concept in the entire unit. When an ERISA plan invests money into a private fund like Sam's private equity vehicle, they are buying equity in the fund. The underlying assets inside the fund, the actual companies or real estate the fund buys, are normally not considered plan assets. They are just the fund's assets.
Right. Ingrid owns a piece of the fund. She doesn't directly own the shopping mall the fund bought.
Exactly. However, a magical, terrifying regulatory transformation occurs if a specific threshold is crossed. If benefit plan investors hold 25% or more of the total value of any class of equity interest in that fund, the corporate veil is pierced.
The underlying assets of the fund suddenly legally become plan assets under ERISA.
Yes. And if the assets inside Sam's fund are now legally classified as ERISA plan assets, the implications are staggering. It means that whoever exercises control over those assets in this case, Sam, the sponsor, the manager of the private equity fund, is suddenly dragged kicking and screaming into the ERISA framework. Sam legally transforms into an ERISA fiduciary.
That is wild. It is a regulatory contagion. It's like dropping a single drop of powerful red food coloring into a massive glass of water. If enough ERISA money enters the private pool, the entire pool changes color, and the fund manager is completely infected by the ERISA rules. Sam is suddenly subject to the prudent expert rule and the prohibited transaction restrictions, even though he thought he was just running a standard private equity fund.
Contagion is the perfect metaphor. The DOWL forces the manager to become a fiduciary to protect that massive concentration of retirement wealth. But for the exam, you cannot just know the concept. You have to know exactly how that 25% math is calculated, because it is not a straightforward, simple fraction.
Right. Let's do the math on this. When calculating that 25% threshold, you must strip out any equity held by the manager or advisor of the fund. You must leave Sam's own personal stake out of the denominator entirely.
Let's explain the why behind that math. Why does the Department of Labor mandate that exclusion?
Let's think like a devious fund manager. Suppose Sam has a $100 million fund. $24 million of it is ERISA money. He is at 24%. He is safe from the contagion.
Barely.
But Ingrid wants to invest another $2 million of pension money. That would push the ERISA total to $26 million out of $102 million. That's over 25%. The contagion hits. Sam becomes a fiduciary.
Right, he crosses the line.
Sam doesn't want that. So what if Sam just dumps $5 million of his own personal cash into the fund on the same day? Now the fund is $107 million total. The $26 million of ERISA money is suddenly only 24.2% of the new artificially inflated total. Sam diluted the pool to save himself.
And that is exactly what the Department of Labor anticipated. The DOL says, no, your money does not count in the math. We are measuring the concentration of ERISA money against the truly independent investor money.
So smart.
By stripping the manager's equity out of the calculation, a holding that looks safely under 25% on a plain, naive count can very easily cross the threshold once the manager's stake is removed from the denominator.
That is brilliant anti-loophole engineering. And there is one final exam trap hiding in this contagion rule. The threshold is 25% of a class of equity interest. It is not 25% of the total dollar size of the entire private placement offering.
That is a classic function two distractor.
Right. If Sam's fund issues Class A voting stock and Class B non-voting stock, you don't lump them together. You must run the 25% test against the Class A shares independently, and then run a separate 25% test against the Class B shares independently. If the ERISA money crosses 25% in either class, the contagion triggers and Sam is a fiduciary.
Never let them trick you with the total offering language. It is always calculated per class.
Deep breath. Wow, we have covered an unbelievable amount of ground today.
We really have.
We have taken Ingrid from the velvet rope of the VIP line, dragged her through the mud of mandatory signatures and reasonable efforts, moved her across the country to test the 6-year retention clocks, survived a vicious fight in the arbitration forum, and navigated the absolute minefield of ERISA fiduciary contagion. We have explored the why and the how. Now it is time to lock it in for exam day. We are not just going to read flashcards. We are going to trace our steps backwards through the logic we just built.
I am ready. Let's run the recap.
Let's do it. We started at the door. What is the mathematical threshold for the catch-all category to become an institutional account?
Total assets, not net worth of at least $50 million. But always remember the VIP exception. Banks, insurance companies, and registered advisors skip that test entirely. Size doesn't matter for them.
Riley gets the account open. Ingrid wants him to fly the plane. What specific record must be maintained for a discretionary account?
The firm must have the dated signature of the associated person authorized to exercise discretion on file. Do not confuse this record-keeping requirement with the separate compliance process of obtaining the customer's written authorization.
We get to the paperwork. Ingrid stubbornly refuses to provide a trusted contact person. What happens?
The firm relies on the reasonable efforts provision. If they asked, explained the reasoning, and documented her refusal, they can still legally open and maintain the account without the actual name. It is not an absolute barrier.
We hit the timeline traps. When do you need a U.S. person's tax ID versus when do you need their occupation?
Due to the severe anti-money laundering mandates of the federal CIP rules, the tax ID is required before account opening. Conversely, the occupation and employer information falls under the fine ARA rule requiring reasonable efforts prior to the settlement of the initial transaction.
Life changes. Riley gets promoted and hands Ingrid's account to a new rep internally. Administrative courtesy or regulatory event?
That is a firm-driven change, and it is a strict record-keeping event. The firm must formally update the file to reflect the new associated person responsible for the account.
The relationship sours. We go to arbitration. How does a client force an arbitration panel to issue an explained decision?
It requires a joint request by all parties involved, and that unanimous request must be formally submitted at least 20 days before the first scheduled hearing date.
What are the two distinct delivery clocks for that arbitration agreement?
The firm has an unprompted duty to deliver it within 30 days of signing. But if the customer requests a copy, the firm must deliver it within 10 business days. The critical rule is overlap. The firm must meet whichever deadline occurs earlier.
Ingrid puts on her corporate hat. We enter ERISA. Which major plan types are famously statutorily exempt from ERISA?
Government plans like municipal pensions and church plans, unless they specifically elect in.
Riley gives a hot stock tip over a steak dinner. Does the doll consider him a fiduciary for giving advice?
No. To be a fiduciary, by virtue of advice, he must hit all five prongs of the five-part test, which critically includes providing advice on a regular basis and operating under a mutual agreement that his advice will be a primary basis for investment decisions. A casual tip fails immediately.
And finally, what specific metric triggers the terrifying ERISA contagion for Sam, the sponsor, managing a private placement?
The 25% threshold. If benefit plan investors hold 25% or more of any single class of equity interest, the underlying assets become plan assets, and the manager becomes an ERISA fiduciary. And critically, you must exclude the manager's own equity stake from the calculation to prevent artificial dilution.
Absolutely incredible. We have systematically dismantled function two.
We really have. We explored the deep architecture of the rules. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a broader thought to ponder.
Go for it.
We talked extensively today about how moving an account to a new rep is a record-keeping event, and how touching a legacy file wakes the sleeping bear of compliance. Think about the massive implications of that reality. In a financial industry that is built almost entirely on interpersonal relationships and handshakes, every single time a piece of paper shifts hands, the regulatory liability shifts with it. The paperwork is not an administrative afterthought. It is the very foundation upon which the entire relationship rests.
The foundation.
Exactly. So ask yourself this question. When you pass this exam and you eventually sit down in Riley's chair at a major firm and a massive stack of 20-year-old legacy files is dropped on your desk, how much blind trust are you genuinely willing to place in the paperwork of the person who sat in that chair before you? Because if their foundation is cracked, if they missed a signature, if they ignored a reasonable effort, if they misclassified an institutional client, it is your career and your building that eventually falls down.
That is a terrifying, brilliant, and deeply sobering thought to leave on. Thank you so much for guiding us through this labyrinth today. Listener, you are going to crush this section. Trust your studying, remember the why behind the rules, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.